Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an update on the tragic portent of a civil war in the world's newest country, South Sudan, and speak with Sondra Hale, a professor of anthropology at UCLA, who has been studying, doing fieldwork, and living in Sudan for over 50 years. We'll discuss the growing chaos in South Sudan, where three U.S. military aircraft came under fire, wounding four U.S. service members attempting to evacuate American citizens, as the feud between the president and the former vice president that has divided the country along tribal lines now threatens to explode into a wider war. Then we'll look into a brewing battle for the soul and future direction of the Democratic Party that erupted following criticism of New York's new mayor Bill de Blasio and Senator Elizabeth Warren's economic populism from a centrist group, Third Way. Adam Green, the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee that helps progressive candidates run progressive campaigns and win, joins us to discuss the battle that will have implications for how the Democrats will frame their 2014 campaign and who will be the Democratic presidential candidate in 2016. Then finally, we'll be joined in the studio by a Syrian doctor who fled her country and will be speaking to us using the name of Damas because her Alawite family will be tortured and murdered by the Assad regime if her real identity is revealed. We will discuss the latest indications that after both Obama and Hillary Clinton confidently stated Assad would fall while doing nothing to make that happen, the U.S. now appears to be maneuvering to accept Assad's continuing dictatorship as the least worst option. And joining us now is Sondra Hale, who is a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Los Angeles, who has been studying, doing fieldwork in and living in Sudan for over 50 years. She is the author of numerous books and articles, including Locating Sudan Studies, Gender Politics in Sudan, and her forthcoming book is Sudan's Killing Fields, Political Violence and Fragmentation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sondra Hale.
Thank you.
And I'm not sure what the fate of the American citizens that the U.S. military were trying to evacuate from this town that seems to be at the heart of this battle. It looks like it could erupt into a civil war between the former vice president and the current president. Is there any news? As far as I know, the wounded American service people are being treated in Kenya, I think they are. No, Entebbe, in Uganda. But at this point, do you have any information, Sondra, about the fate of those Americans they were trying to evacuate when they were shot at?
The latest that I heard, and I'm not sure it's confirmed, and we can't know yet. We may know in an hour or so, but the latest that I heard was that they have been evacuated. And that's as much as I can tell you about that very chaotic and ever-changing and dynamic situation on the ground.
And the town of Bor seems to be largely controlled by the vice president's the former vice president's forces.
Yes, Bor is important for a number of reasons. It's not a very large place. I can't give you the population figures right now, but it's the capital of Junglai State, which is a crucial state because of oil production, because of where it is vis-a-vis the border. But also, Bor is important because it was the site in 1991 of a massacre of Dinka by Nuer. And so the Dinka who live in that area are extremely nervous, and it could very well be, Bor could be the meeting place, so to speak, of the elements of a civil war. We hope not, but it could be. So instead of it being Juba, which we might expect, although Juba is very chaotic right now and very dangerous, it may well be that Bor would be the spark.
But Salva Kiir, the president, he's an ethnic Dinka, is he not? And my understanding is that both the Dinka and the Nuer, even though they're the first and second biggest tribes, they do not represent the majority of the people. So what's happening to the silent minority, or majority, I should say?
Well, the silent majority has been, there have just dozens and dozens of ethnic groups that have been both at peace and at war over the many, many decades. The reason that the Dinka and the Noor are so prominent right now in the government is because the Dinka were the majority in the SPLM, the Sudanese People's Liberation Movement, which is, in fact, the government now of South Sudan, even though they brought in elements from other ethnic groups, namely the Noor. So I think that, yes, it's true that the Dinka and the Noor together, even though the Dinka is the largest ethnic group and the Noor the second largest ethnic group, together they make up about 15% of the total population of South Sudan, but they are dominant for so many other reasons.
So this is obviously a terrible tragedy, given this is the world's newest country and there was so much hope for it. And it is has very, very rich in oil resources, although it's somewhat complicated. The oil is extracted in the south and is sent to market via the north, from which it broke away. What kind of revenues are we talking about here? And I imagine by now, given that most of this fighting is taking place in the oil-rich province, that I don't imagine the oil is flowing.
No, the oil is not flowing, and that means an economic disaster, because oil is the main commodity. Unfortunately, because so many of the other forms of economic development, possible economic development, were destroyed during the war, and that infrastructure has not been built up, and so there's this total reliance on oil, which is a major mistake. In my view, the government of South Sudan should have concentrated on building up farming and animal raising and so on, but instead all emphasis went on oil. And then when oil production is cut off, it's a major, major crisis.
So what... How can you explain to our audience, again, let me remind the audience that I'm speaking with Sandra Hale, who's a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Los Angeles. She's been studying, doing field work, and living in Sudan for over 50 years, and she's the author of numerous books and articles, including Locating Sudan Studies, Gender Politics in Sudan, and her forthcoming book is Sudan's Killing Fields, Political Violence and Fragmentation. How do you explain the fact that this appears to be the result of a personal feud between the current president, Salva Kiir, an ethnic Dinka, and Riek Machar, who is an ethnic Noor? The idea that these two men, for whatever reasons, would want to subject their country to civil war and to wanton bloodshed and destruction and destroy this fragile emerging country, for what? Why can't they see beyond their own animus, ambition, whatever drives them?
Well, we're assuming that, you're assuming anyway, that they're acting as individuals. They are acting as very important representatives of their ethnic group. And this is the problem with any kind of nation building. South Sudan is not a nation yet. South Sudan is just a country with some borders drawn around it. And it's up to these various leaders to try to think beyond their particular ethnic group. So I don't think it's so much a animosity between two individuals, although that is there. It really is animosity between two very large and powerful ethnic groups. And it's to their, I mean, one can understand, since there isn't, there hasn't been instilled in the citizenry the idea of a nation yet, one can understand that people are still mired in their particular ethnic identities and what is good for their particular, or what they see as best for their ethnic group. It makes sense to me that they have not yet moved out of these kinds of more local loyalties.
Well, you mentioned a little while ago, Sandra Hale, that there's a history of bloodletting between the Noor and the Dinka that took place in the very town that they're fighting over now, Bor.
Yes. That's true. So we have a long history of animosities that really supersede any kind of individual animosities.
So with the North Sudan or Sudan having allowed, I guess, its country to be divided, with the South forming a new country, and the oil being in the South but being transported through pipelines through the North, is the Omar Bashir's government, are they in any way sort of triumphant? Is there any sort of I told you so moment going on there in Khartoum?
Well, I won't be in Khartoum until until January 20th, so I can't tell you exactly what it's like on the ground. My phone conversations have said a number of things. One is that it's as if nothing is going on in South Sudan. Life goes on as usual in North Sudan. However, one can't quite believe that. One has to believe that there's a great amount of anxiety about what could happen, because after all, with each one of these crises, the oil production is in doubt, and the North is as dependent on that oil production as the South is, or maybe almost as dependent. And so we have to assume there's a great amount of nervousness. I suppose there's a certain arrogance about among government leaders with regard to the South, in their eyes, South Sudan not making it as an independent country. But it's really not to their advantage at all to have South Sudan explode into chaos.
Well, apparently things started to fall apart in South Sudan back in February when Salva Kiir, the president, ordered more than 100 army generals to retire. Now, the idea that there are 100 generals, for God's sake, in the first place is pretty bizarre.
It's pretty bizarre, yes.
You know, who's supplying arms? We know where the North gets its arms from, but where does the South?
Well, that's unclear. It may be clear to some people. It's unclear to me. Israel, for one. That's the latest rumor I've heard.
Mm-hmm.
I can't answer the question. I really don't know.
Well, what we do know, though, is that right next door, the Central African Republic is falling apart in sectarian violence in a country that's predominantly Christian. There was a coup by a minority government largely made up of Muslims, and it's led to massacres and counter-massacres along sectarian lines. If that becomes a failed state right next door, wouldn't that impact the chaos further in South Sudan?
Well, we can assume that it would, because there would be refugees flowing over the border. There would be militia flowing over the border. There would be free exchanges of weaponry of one kind or another, captured weaponry. Of course it would add to the chaos. Any kind of crisis, any kind of conflict that's occurring in any of the bordering countries would only add to the grief.
So in terms of governance in South Sudan, I mentioned the fact that there were 100 army generals who were ordered to retire. I don't know how many were left.
And ministers were fired as well.
Right. And the entire cabinet was fired in July of this year, along with the vice president, Riek Machar. And apparently a probe uncovered 11,000 fake names on the police payroll, with another 16,000 considered suspect. This kind of stuff goes on, does it not, in many of these corrupt third world countries?
Well, just as that sort of thing goes on in many corrupt Western countries,
that's
including
true.
The United States.
Well, I don't know how many. I don't know how many fake people are on the LAPD, but there's certainly a lot of corruption in this country. Nobody would deny.
Well, I wasn't necessarily pointing to the LAPD, but just the corruption in general. I think if we put the U.S. side by side with South Sudan, I think we'd be pretty good competitors in terms of who is more corrupt. But that's not really what you wanted to get at. Yes, of course, there's a great deal of corruption, but I think we could expect that in a new country where there is so much juggling for power and individual ambitions and the ambitions of ethnic groups and so on, without the kind of history of sort of checks and balances that that a country, let's say, like the U.S. may have set up. And even though we're not able to control our corruption completely, at least there are mechanisms that could, you know, could be more effectively put into play. In terms of South Sudan, there's not been time for these mechanisms to be set up. And there was all that oil money flowing around and just so much fluidity in terms of people moving in and out of positions and positions of power, et cetera. I think it's to be expected. That's no surprise at all. In fact, very little of what is happening is a surprise. That, in many ways, is what is tragic to me, is that these are not surprises. So much of it was set up with colonialism. So much of it was set up with the badly handled Comprehensive Peace Agreement of 2005, and where only certain parties were invited to the table for this very important negotiation. Darfur was left out, for example, of consideration, and many of the ethnic groups in South Sudan were left out. I mean, the situation was just set up for this kind of crisis, and we can only hope that there will be some wise people who can manage to get people talking again, and that it'll not just be a peace agreement, that in fact various mechanisms will be put in place to avoid some of these conflicts in the future and avoid the corruption, or at least to minimize it and to minimize the conflicts and so on.
So just in the last couple of minutes, Sandra Hale, since the oil fields were developed by the Chinese and they are the biggest customer for Sudan's oil, it comes from the south but goes through pipelines through the north. What is the are the Chinese in any way playing a helpful role here?
I don't know. I would imagine that they're trying to play a helpful role. They mm-hmm. would not. They would be foolish if they weren't trying to intervene in some way because, as you say, they have a lot at stake economically. Whether or not they are among the arms suppliers, arms negotiations that went awry, I don't know. We're not hearing very much about the Chinese at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So I imagine these are mainly very, very low-profile negotiations of one kind or another.
Well, we do know that the UN lost a helicopter. It was shot down, and the U.S. Air Force evacuated wounded personnel for medical treatment, and that the UN are pulling out. So who is going to mediate here?
No, that's a very, very good question. We also don't know how much mediation is going on from the north. I mean, that's one of my big questions, is just exactly what is Sudan doing now with regard to South Sudan? Are there any negotiators there? Or is the situation entirely too hot to see the faces of former northern Sudanese in the south in any role whatsoever? If they're firing on the UN and firing on the U.S., as you say, it makes it very unclear who can negotiate at this point. Maybe no one right now. Maybe there has to be much more, much more bloodshed and some kinds of breakthroughs in the local area before outside negotiators can be very effective.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Sandra Hale.
Yes, wish I had better news, and I'm sure you do too.
Well, I agree, and thank you again. Sandra
thank
Hale
you.
is a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Los Angeles. She's been studying, doing field work, and living in Sudan for over 50 years. She's the author of numerous books and articles, including Locating Sudan Studies, Gender Politics in Sudan, and her forthcoming book is Sudan's Killing Fields, Political Violence and Fragmentation. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the battle brewing for the soul and the future direction of the Democratic Party.
Some people lost some bread. Someone nearly died. Someone just died. Police, they come. Army, they come. Confusion everywhere. 7 minutes later, all don't cool down, brother. Police don't go away. Army don't disappear. Them leave sorrow, tears and blood.
Idiot wind blowing in through the front door. Idiot wind blowing in from the back. Idiot wind blowing in from every crevice, every crack. Anybody wanna tell it like it is to each other? Like you would to a sister or a brother. Cut this cosmopolitan.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Adam Green, who's the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, dedicated to helping progressive candidates run progressive campaigns and win. He recently finished a stint as interim CEO of Change Congress, a reform group formed by Harvard Professor Lawrence Lessig to reform congressional elections and special interest influence in Congress. And Adam formerly served as the Director of Strategic Campaigns and Civic Communications for MoveOn.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adam Green.
Hey, good to be here, Ian.
And Adam, this manifesto I guess it was an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal by the Third Way, this group of largely corporate Wall Street lobbyists, as far as I can tell, they were very critical of Bill de Blasio's and Elizabeth Warren's economic populism. And a lot of course, analysts thought that with the election of Bill de Blasio and indeed of Elizabeth Warren, we are, after all, supposedly in a democracy. So presumably if the people speak via elections, then that means something. So why is that being discounted?
Well, you know, first of all, Third Way is basically a Wall Street-funded corporate front group that purports to give Democrats good political advice and policy advice, but is actually generally giving them very unpopular positions to take and doing so at the behest of their corporate donors. That's kind of the rationale for a lot of this. You know, their argument in this Wall Street Journal op-ed, you know, placed in Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal of all places, was that because Elizabeth Warren is from a blue state and Bill de Blasio is from a blue city, the Democrats should dismiss out of hand their economic populism message. But they actually referenced the state of Colorado as a purple state. And their main line of attack against Elizabeth Warren was that she supports expanding, not cutting Social Security benefits. The thing is, Ian, that we've done polling in Colorado, and by 3-1, Elizabeth Warren's message of expanding Social Security is popular. Also, reforming Wall Street is popular. Taxing the rich is popular in purple, red, and blue states. So basically, you know, what we did in reaction to that op-ed was really publicize the fact that they're funded by Wall Street. And I think the net effect is that a lot of people on Capitol Hill who otherwise might have listened to them know that that's not a very good idea, that they're actually advancing unpopular positions that are the Wall Street positions.
Well, one of the ironies in this country, Adam Green, is that it's taken billionaires to make the point that the growing divide between the rich and the poor and the growing income inequality in this country is bad for America and bad for its future. People like Warren Buffett, Bill Gates' father, etc., have spoken out. And I don't know whether it's a case that only in America we're such slaves to wealth and that we can't figure this out on our own. But I would think that given that the debate has already been engaged about income inequality, isn't it time to start educating the public? And because the minute they figure this out, I think they're going to be on the side of reform and fairness and redistribution.
Yeah, so there's a couple issues there. One unfortunate fact is that both political parties have really been co-opted by big corporations and corporate executives. And that's why so often you see Democrats not addressing these issues of income inequality or advancing economic populism agenda, right? It's easy to point out that Todd Akin said crazy stuff last cycle on social issues, and all that was true, but sometimes that's used as an excuse by Democrats to not have to take on the truly powerful, you know, Wall Street and other corporate interests. But what Elizabeth Warren proves consistently over and over again is that that's what inspires people. And unfortunately, what the Tea Party showed was that if Democrats fail to embrace the economic populism message, the Tea Party will jump into that void and kind of funnel that populism in the wrong direction, getting people to vote against their own interests, but only because the Tea Party is, you know, the only one addressing those populist needs. So, you know, our message to Democrats is if you want to win big in 2014, if you want to win big in 2016, and P.S., if you want to help millions and millions of people, let's start following Elizabeth Warren's lead. Consider her the North Star that we're marching towards every single day, and that's the way forward. You know, there's one other point that's worth mentioning, which is that, you know, billionaires aren't the only ones advancing that message. There's groups like ours, which have about a million grassroots activists, others like Howard Dean's Democracy for America and Russ Feingold's Progressives United, MoveOn.org, where I used to work, that are also really attempting to mobilize the grassroots around this fight. But you're right, it is an uphill battle because there's so much co-option by the big guys in our political system.
And isn't there a sort of pattern, though, with the Democrats is that they usually run, their campaigns are usually dictated more by how much the other side screws up rather than by how much they inspire their voters to come out and vote for them?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true. And it's something that actually the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, boldprogressives.org, is attempting to solve. So one of our goals is to get as many progressive Democrats to really campaign on offense this election cycle, to inspire voters, to educate voters, frankly, about new ideas. And I'll tell you just a quick little story. You know, in June of this year, a bunch of grassroots organizations that are progressive sat down together at a conference called Netroots Nation. And we made a concerted decision that we were going to stop playing defense on Social Security, because as you know, even the White House proposed cutting Social Security benefits. And we thought that the best defense was a strong offense, and we were going to go on offense and advance this idea of expanding Social Security benefits. And there were these two bills in the Senate, one by Tom Harkin from the rural state of Iowa, and one from Mark Begich from the red state of Alaska, that would expand benefits, but nobody was talking about. And our goal was that by the end of the year, we would make this idea credible. And in 2014, we wanted candidates to campaign on it. You know, then in 2015, we'll start a serious legislative strategy. And, you know, through a lot of hard work and working with our partners like Elizabeth Warren and Sherrod Brown in the Senate, we've managed to make this, you know, front page news in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and get this on national TV. And now a lot of the political debate is actually about whether we should expand Social Security or cut it, not just should we do nothing or cut it. So that, you know, I think that speaks to your point about, you know, are we only relying on people to screw up? You know, that has been the template in the past, but our hope is that this cycle will start breaking away from that.
And again, I'm speaking with Adam Green, who's the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, dedicated to helping progressive candidates run progressive campaigns and win. He recently finished a stint as interim CEO of Change Congress, a reform group formed by Harvard professor Lawrence Lessig to reform congressional elections and special interest influence on Congress. And Adam formerly served as director of strategic campaigns and civic communications for MoveOn.org. So is there, though, I mean, a lot of people rationalize the sort of centrist DLC mantra of the Democratic Party by suggesting that America really is a centrist country and that there is no traction on the left. And they cite the examples of McGovern's blowout defeat to Nixon in 72, of Reagan's defeat of Mondale and of a very beatable George Bush Sr.'s defeat of Dukakis. So what is your argument against that kind of note of caution that the centrist Democrats keep referring to?
Well, you know, there's a couple of things going on here. So one, you know, there's always a question of which issues are dominating the news, which issues are most in the public consciousness. And, you know, in eras where, say, national security trumped economic issues, you know, that's where Republicans really attempted to kind of, you know, assert, you know, strength and assert that Democrats were weak and win on those messages. But really, since the Wall Street collapse, economic populism and, you know, basically the little guy's struggle in our economy has been front and center. And again, even when the Tea Party kicked off, they had a twofold message. One was anti-government. The other was anti-Wall Street. Right? The, you know, the millionaires basically funded the buses to Tea Party rallies, and surprise, surprise, those buses led to protests of Congress instead of protests to Wall Street. But even then, the hunger was there. And, you know, we've been doing polling state by state. Again, red states like Texas and Kentucky, purple states like Colorado and Iowa. And this idea of expanding Social Security benefits is popular by 3-1 in Texas, 2-1 in Kentucky, of all places. And in the swing state of Iowa, 2-1 there. So, you know, it's really a question of, at this point, do Democrats get it? Do Democrats recognize the moment that we're living in, that everyday people are crying out for somebody to be willing to hold powerful people accountable and to be willing to really go to bat for little guy? And if they do, you know, my prediction is that, you know, we would have a Democratic tidal wave in 2016, and even starting in 2014, if Democrats, you know, bucked their own corporate donors and went in this direction. And the only thing that I think can mess Democrats up in these next two election cycles is really shooting ourselves in the, you know, in our own feet by not embracing this economic populism message. And I think the fact that Elizabeth Warren had, you know, the most grassroots fundraising and was one of the biggest upsets of 2012 shows the political opportunity that is there for Democrats to choose to seize this mantle.
So, Adam, in terms of the press, and some a lot of people think that the mainstream press, corporate press, is simply hostile to working Americans and anybody on the left. And then there's the other argument that it's up to political groups to figure out how to use the press to their advantage. And you've just pointed out how the billionaires who funded the Tea Party very cleverly framed it and funded it and got it on the news. And after all, this minority of the far right of the Republican Party, for a while there, seemed to be, you know, dictating the entire nation's political future. Until they crashed and burned. For example, what's happening now in Detroit is an absolute disgrace, and it's an unnecessary bankruptcy imposed by a partisan Republican governor who self-appointed hitman has been put into Detroit, which is a Democratic city, to basically force it into bankruptcy. And now the U.S. bankruptcy judge has halted the proceedings because it turns out that the mayor who's in jail and his top business guy who made all of these complicated derivatives and swap deals with Wall Street just before the crash is the main reason why the city is broke. And the governor's flunky or hitman who comes from a law firm that specializes in bankruptcy, he is planning on paying out the same banks who brought about the bankruptcy 82 cents on the dollars while paying out the pensioners, the firemen, the police, and city workers 16 cents on the dollars for a crash that, one, is the bankruptcy itself is unnecessary, and two, it was caused by Wall Street, not by bloated public pensions, which are only $19,000 a year. To me, that is a real sort of example of the obscenity of this income inequality and the power of Wall Street over Main Street.
Yeah, that's a great point. This is one of the probably, definitely one of the under-discussed issues of our time, which is the idea that, you know, you can't break your contract with the very wealthy, and that extended to Wall Street too when during the crisis, the meltdown, you know, the idea of cutting CEO bonuses was just anathema because they have a contract. But for some reason, you know, labor union contracts, pension contracts, things that help millions of people just have the ability to live in their retirement, for some reason, you know, those can get pennies on the dollar and you can break the law. It's really unfortunate, and it isn't even an object of debate. It's great that you just brought it up, but, you know, people aren't debating this on the Senate floor right now. You know, hopefully that will change over the next couple of years you know, as we have Elizabeth Warren and other people like Elizabeth Warren, Sherrod Brown, Jack Merkley, Brian Schatz, and other progressive senators. But to your other point, you know, previously about, you know, the media, I thought that was also a really interesting question because, you know, on the one hand, I don't want to give, you know, what you call the corporate media a pass by saying it's, you know, it's not their fault. You know, part of this is their fault, whether it's outward, you know, bad motives or even more likely just kind of being in a bubble and being, you know, not in the loop on the struggles everyday Americans are, you know, are facing. You know, they have a responsibility to do better. And I would call out David Gregory from Meet the Press as one of the, you know, really worst actors in terms of consistently just saying as a fact that we need to cut Social Security and just really not knowing the math behind the program. Right. Or the proposals on the table.
Sure. Well, Adam, don't you remember the second presidential debate with Obama, where the moderator from ABC, Martha Raddatz, started out by saying, well, we know that Social Security is going bankrupt, which is a total lie. I mean, that was the framing of the question. You know, by the way, I forgot to mention talking about the Detroit, the guy that made the sweetheart deal, the city official that made the sweetheart deal with the Wall Street banks, which is the main reason the city's gone bankrupt, and is that he then ends up working for one of these banks. I mean, hello. It's just an outrage. You know, I want to see more of the truth about, you know, this mechanism of income equality and why it's happening. And you got one family, the Waltons, who control the equivalent of the entire wealth of 40% of all Americans. I mean, it's, you know, anyway, unfortunately, I shouldn't be talking. You should be talking. And I'm sorry to go on about it, but I find it really disgraceful. And I'm grateful for you for the work that you do, Adam Green.
Oh, I like your passion. And also, you know, it's really important that, you know, people like you are there helping this message to break through. And everything you say, I totally agree with, you know, about these issues. You know, the one thing I would add, you know, I want to give people hope. It's not just a bleary world where we have no hope. You know, I think that, you know, in addition to the, you know, corporate media needs to do a better job, you know, there is a template for success for progressives, breaking into the media and changing the narrative. And I think this Social Security expansion debate is really key to look at. It's kind of like a model.
Right.
Basically, you know, we do our best work when we have strong partners on the inside, not just allies, actual partners, people who plan strategy with us. And Elizabeth Warren, you know, because, you know, it's just in her nature. She understands the importance of, you know, how a national grassroots movement can help her do her job better. And she helps us do our job better.
Well, Adam, I thank you so much. I'm afraid we ran out of time, but I really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks, Ian. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Adam Green, the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. He is formerly with the CEO of Change Congress and served as Director of Strategic Campaigns and Civil Communications for MoveOn.org. We're going to take a brief station break and be joined in the studio by a Syrian doctor who will give us an update on the hideous conditions in her country. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Damas, who is a medical doctor. She is from the Alawite community in Syria. She's escaped with her life. We cannot reveal her true name and show her picture on our website, ianmasters.com, because her family would be murdered by the regime. So with that said, welcome to Background Briefing. Damas.
Thank you.
And tell me, you grew up in a country that's been ruled by one family for as long as you know, right?
Yeah, for more than 40 years.
Right. So the streets, everywhere you go, there are pictures of...
And sculptures for them also.
Right. So this is a combination of a mafia family and Stalinist rule. That seems to be the way it is.
Yeah, that's right.
The cult of personality.
Yeah.
Secret police.
Yeah. And
controlling the country.
Yeah. And idealizing of one person.
Right. And his family, right?
Yeah.
So let's talk about then, for example, what would happen to your family if the Muhabarat, the secret police, found out that you would...
As I'm here now in the U.S., they can't really get me anymore. So they for sure will go for my family. They will punish me through my family. They will arrest my father and mom and maybe my sisters also. They will torture them for sure. Then they may release them and they may keep them as kind of pressure on me to reveal my name. And actually, that's really common in Syria. There's that Syrian famous musician. His name is Malik Jandali. He lives here in the U.S. And he was one of the first people who expressed his opinion that he's against Assad when the revolution started back in 2011. And they went for his parents, and they are in their 80s. And, you know, they are really old, and they arrested them and tortured them. And that also happened to one of my cousins. She lives also here, and they went for her brother.
So when the revolution started 33 months ago, I understand that you and your fellow doctors and medical students treated the wounded that were shot down by the regime just for taking to the streets. What happened to some of your friends in the prisons? There are about 300,000 people, as far as we know, in Assad's prisons.
Yeah, and the actual number is much bigger than that.
So tell me what happened to your friends when they were arrested.
They arrested back when in March 2011, after the revolution started. They arrested the three of my close friends. And for sure, they arrested them from the university. It's a way to humiliate them in front of everybody. And after arresting them, for sure, they were hitting them when they were on their way to the prison. And when they were in the same prison, they couldn't even recognize themselves. They recognized each other by voice because their face bones were really broken. And one of my friends, his name is Muhammad, he's still there. They took off his skin, they injected him with diseases. He refused to reveal which is, if it's hepatitis or AIDS, but they did really horrible things.
So, in other words, the prison, Assad's prison doctors inject prisoners with either AIDS or hepatitis?
Yeah, yeah. They inject them with diseases and they took them to special hospitals that's related to this prison that they can, you know, inject them with diseases and torture them there, even in hospitals.
So that they can use medical treatment to keep them alive and conscious so they can inflict more pain.
Yeah.
But on the way out, when they discharge them from prison,
Muhammad
they have a terminal disease.
Yeah,
either AIDS or hepatitis.
Yeah, Muhammad, my friend who was injected with one of these diseases, he said when he was in prison, he was really tortured and he was so desperate. Then they took him to the hospital and he was happy about that because he thought that he would have a break of torturing. And he said that was even worse than staying in the prison.
So it's very clear, Damas, that the U.S. and the West have been reluctant to come to the rescue of Syrians who've been trying to get rid of this family dictatorship and, you know, have stood in the streets and been shot at by the regime because they want freedom and democracy.
Yeah.
How does this make you feel that, because there's an article in Sunday's New York Times by Ryan Crocker, who served as a U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Syria, yeah. Kuwait, Lebanon, etc. He was the dean of the Bush School of Government, former Bush administration State Department official. He's basically now arguing in the New York Times that Assad is the least worst option for the Americans and that they're basically, you know, that Obama should never have said in 2011 that Assad must go. Hillary Clinton said he was going to fall. And he's arguing if you say somebody's going to fall, you have to actually do it. You can't just say that they're going to fall. You have to make them fall or drive them out of office or whatever. So now he's basically saying because we underestimated Assad, now we have to accept the fact that he's there and deal with him. So how does that make you feel?
That's for sure frustrating, but to be honest, that doesn't really surprise me. It has been now almost 2 years and a half, and people are arrested by Assad regime every day. They are tortured, killed. Horrible things are, you know, it's just the horrible situation in Syria. And he's using chemical weapons, and that doesn't really surprise me because there is no coverage on that. They don't really care about that. There was only one coverage for one chemical massacre, which was back in Damascus in August, in Ghouta. And it was the third time to use chemical weapons, and there was no coverage for that. So it doesn't really surprise me, but for sure I'm frustrated and disappointed.
But how does, and again, let me just remind the audience, I'm speaking with Damas, who is a medical doctor. She comes from the Alawite community in Syria. She's escaped with her life, and we cannot reveal her identity nor show her picture. But at this point, how does, or assuming that the U.S. doesn't sell out the rebellion, which it sounds like it will, assuming that they don't, what can the U.S. and the West do? Because, you know, how do you support the freedom fighters without supporting the jihadis, the al-Nusra people?
Yeah, the thing is, since the revolution started, we didn't see any actual movement to support these fighters, freedom fighters. And when you ask me about how we should support them, I just want to know what do you mean exactly by this. But if you mean politically or, you know, to introduce them here to the U.S., at least there's no real coverage in media about these freedom fighters. They present our revolution in the U.S. as it's our Islamic movement, and people who are leading this revolution are radical Islamic groups, which is not true. And at least, you know, to support them, present their real image to the world. They are well-educated people. They are young people who are fighting for their freedom. They are not radical Islamic people.
So, but the head of al-Nusra had a press conference just a few days ago and said that they're going to make an Islamic state in Syria and introduce Sharia law, etc.
Yeah, but the thing is that these people doesn't really represent the rebels.
Right.
It's the way.
Are they Syrian? There are a lot of foreign fighters. I mean, are there Syrians in this radical Islamic?
There is
groups?
Many of them. Yes, they are Syrian, but they don't represent the rebels, and we don't favor a dictator over one. We are not fighting against Assad to start this another dictatorship, you know, state. It's many of them are Syrian, but the thing is, there is a famous journalist in Syria. His name is Arif Hamzi, and he's from Raqqa, and he was really involved with the rebels and in this revolution. And he documented what's happening now in Raqqa, as it's a free city and the Qaeda now is in charge of everything. He documented like how many people are arresting, you know, from the rebels, how they are torturing them. It's just the same system, just a different name. They are not the rebels. They don't represent our revolution. And unfortunately, there is no English translation for these documentations, but this Qaeda and Raqqa, they arrested so far almost in 1 year, 2,000 people of the rebels, and they are torturing them.
Mm-hmm. And this is the group that the Saudi Arabians and the Qataris are supporting.
They pay them money and they give them weapons. They are really well organized and they have their supplies. Mm-hmm. They are really in power.
And they just actually captured some Free Syrian Army warehouses on the Turkish border.
Yeah.
And that's led the British and the Americans to cut off aid to the Free Syrian Army. So, but on the other side, why do people support the Assads? It's clear that that he has some support.
Yeah.
Although I understand from the Alawite community, that there's a split in the Alawite community. Some of the Alawites actually favor his uncle, who's in exile in London.
Yeah, Rafat Assad, right. Yeah.
But tell me why do people, and I believe the Christian community, supports Assad? That's what we're told.
Well, first of all, Christian community doesn't support Assad at all. There is that famous journalist, his name, Basil Shahadi. He's a Christian from Homs. He was here in the U.S. when the revolution started. He got a scholarship to study here in the U.S., which is really hard as he's Syrian, it's really hard to get this scholarship here. And he just quitted his program and went back to Syria just to document what's happening, and they killed him for sure. The Christian community doesn't support Assad, but it's the way that the media wants to present that to people. The Assad supporters, there is no like religion for them. There is no, you can't really just stereotype them. They are not like Alawite or Christian. They are just supporters. Many of them, they have financial interest with Assad regime. They have their investments. They are getting really good money from supporting Assad. And there is another kind of people who support Assad not because of financial interest. And these people, yeah, the majority of them are Alawite and they are from my hometown city. Because I've been there in these villages and I met people who are fighting for Assad. I wanted to listen to their stories and just to understand why they are supporting him. And you find out that there is kind of a brainwashing to them. It's like, you are Alawite. If Assad, goes, all Sunni people will slaughter you and your families. There is this kind of a brainwashing. They are not happy that they're children are going to this war and they are killed, They are not happy about that, but they feel that they are threatened and they need to defend themselves. They need to survive. It's kind of a brainwashing, and they are really very poor people, very poor, simple people. Most of them are farmers. Mm-hmm. They are not even well trained to be soldiers. I know one of these soldiers who went to fight for Assad on Monday. By Wednesday, he was dead. Mm-hmm. He was killed because he was not trained at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, some people say, though, that it's, and I've talked to a lot of analysts who say that it's a standoff, that this war could go on for a decade, that as long as the foreign fighters come in, and as long as Iran and Hezbollah support Assad, they will be able to just continually feed young men into the battlefield.
Yeah.
And the agony will go on. So what's your sense now that you've escaped your country and you were able to get through roadblocks because you have an Alawite identification? What is your sense of how this will end, when this will end, will this end?
Yeah, I don't expect that will end soon at all. I don't really expect that Assad will go, or I don't even expect that the Nusra, as it's the strongest part, against Assad. And I don't really expect that Nusra will win. The thing is, there is also international trend to support both Assad regime and this radical Islamic groups in equal way, that they will keep fighting and none of them will win. There is also, there's this famous journalist, he's Syrian, he was arrested by Hafez Bashar's Assad father. He was arrested and exiled out of Syria. His name is Salami Kaili. He wrote about that, and he documented the way that Saudi is supporting, you know, this radical Islamic group, this Sunni Islamic groups, and how Iran and Hezbollah are supporting these Alawite and Shia groups who are fighting for Assad. And they are supported just in an equal way, just to keep them fighting.
I see.
No one will win.
So that's the cynical interpretation. What about, though, just in the last couple of minutes, you're saying that the press, the American press, are not covering it properly.
No.
Is that because, do you think that America basically sold out Syria?
Yeah.
Hillary and Clinton and Obama said Assad was going to fall, and then they did nothing about it.
Yeah.
And now they're pulling away. They're trying to make a deal with the Iranians.
Yeah.
They're going to sell out the rebellion. I think it's pretty clear. So are they just basically, is our press going along with the idea that maybe Assad is the best option, as Ryan Crocker suggested?
For sure he's not the best option, at least for us. The thing is how we feel like Assyrian people toward this American politics and the way that they react to our revolution. We are really frustrated. And even when they made this crisis and big deal about the American strike after the chemical massacre, and they did not go for it, we were really frustrated. We don't really trust the American system, and we don't really believe that they will help us just because, you know, for humanity and their belief in freedom. We don't believe in that at all. But we believe that they have, like, interest in the Middle East, and they have, like, investments in Syria and in Saudi Arabia and Iran. Is it just about their interest and investments? We don't really believe that they will help us because we are fighting for our freedom. This revolution now, like, it has been like for more than 2 years and a half, and there is no real support to this revolution, no real support, politically or financially, even sending supplies for people like food or medications. They don't even care about doing that, you know. So I don't really think that they will ever support us.
Well, Damas, I thank you very much for joining us here today in the studio.
Thank you.
And you're a very brave woman, and I appreciate your coming in here to speak with us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Damas, who is from the Alawite community in Syria. She's a medical doctor. She managed to escape from Syria, largely because of her identity papers being an Alawite, part of the regime, if you will, and was able to come here to the United States, and we're very grateful.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.